Came in before.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
I heard you sent it up twice. Like the Muppet. All right, let me go. I'll go.
But can I just use my phone? We're not going to stay on the second
Muppet.
They sent their own letter. I got a copy from Robin last night.
Yeah.
A letter. And then I called Dennis and I said to Dennis,
Do you have the PowerPoint?
The one that they gave us.
Yeah.
It was pretty lame.
Yeah.
It's just that don't use words like financial problems.
Okay.
It was
from
Robin. I mean, I don't know, I shouldn't say that, but
you have to
have CD's fiscal intermediary. So that was the CD payment. Yeah, that was another one. I just got one from CCLC 5 minutes ago.
I know, I'm trying to get the ones that came through on my
computer.
I mean, my issue, and because I spoke to Scott, I spoke to Dennis, we have a whole couple of people.
Yeah.
I don't, when you tell me you don't want it to be an insurance model, then I say to you, well, what is the issue? You're going to have reserves for insurance. You're going to go ahead and say, when I spend it, I'm done. Or you have to keep reserves, which is proof, which is an insurance form. So if you give me a design that works, that maybe has less reserves, that I can buy.
I didn't get a chance to talk to Jenny yesterday.
Central New York.
Mary Harper, New York City HRA.
Doug Goggin Callahan, Medicare Rights.
Carol Rodat, PHI.
Marilyn Saviola, ICS.
David McNally, AARP.
Melanie Shaw, the New York Association on Independent Living. Joanne Costantino, the Yeti. Kathy Shore, Greater New York Hospital Association.
Mark Kissinger, Department of Health.
Eli Feldman, MJHS.
And I'm Carol Raphael. Do we have anyone on the phone?
Hello, this is Kate Bishop. I'm from OPWDD, covering for Commissioner Burke, who should be joining us during the course of the meeting.
Okay, thank you. So first of all, let me thank Michael Birnbaum, a member of our work group, for being so accommodating and for his hospitality. I also want to just let people know that if you need the coat room, there is a coat room right out here, and the restrooms are down the hall. So let me just start by saying what is our goal today. We have our MRT meeting on November 1st when Eli Feldman and I are due to report on the recommendations of this work group. So we would hope today to reach agreement on the recommendations of this work group. And let me start by saying that that means to me that the recommendations are not as each and every one of you would have written them. They are hopefully what we can agree to as common ground based on the perspectives and experience that we all bring to it. Secondly, some of you have said to me, well, these are pretty general, you know, and it is true, like everything else. The devil is in the details, and a lot will depend on the actual implementation. And if you think there is something that we need to do as this rolls out and the details are fleshed out, that can be a recommendation, because I personally believe that there's no way you can ever have a plan that's going to be predictive of everything you're going to encounter and all the issues that you're going to have to tackle. And thirdly, now I have a good friend who headed long-term care in the state of Washington, and I know someone also from Oregon, and they have been lamenting that their really very, I think, excellent long-term care systems due to Medicaid cutbacks are beginning to unravel. And we are at a time of considerable financial constraints, and our goal is to try to redesign a flagship long-term care system in this state that's affordable, that represents quality, that hopefully will pave the way, even though we do live at a time that is tough economically. I mean, that's what I'm trying to think about. We're designing a system that will hopefully live for decades, not just for the next year or two. And the last thing I would conclude by saying is that when I look at our work group compared to other work groups, ours is tougher. Why is it tougher? Because it's very real. We are implementing a system in 2012. It's not aspirational. We're not talking about 2018 here. We're talking about something that's actually going to happen and affect many lives. And I think that's why our task is more challenging. I'm not going to get into a competition here with other work groups, but nonetheless, as I looked at the work groups and their products and I read all of the recommendations that have come out so far, it really made me realize that we do have one of the toughest tasks. So with those introductory comments, Eli, I'm going to turn it over to you.
What's left to say? I see this as a very important bridge that we're crossing right now. If you think back to everything that we've done in the very short time frame that we've done it, we're in a sea of change. We are on waters where the ship is sinking, the healthcare delivery ship is sinking. And we're trying to salvage the water, move the water out of the ship while we're rebuilding the ship to make it stronger at the same time. So, again, I know at the meetings that we've had over the summer and that we continue to have now, all of us are not 100% happy with everything that, you know, we're doing relative to the building of that ship or the rebuilding of the ship. But I am very pleased. I think that we've really constructively been able to go ahead and come up with recommendations that after we have and conclude our discussion today, we'll go to the full MRT and they'll have their opportunity to, raise issues or deal with specifics of it. But I'm very pleased at the work that we've done, and I want to thank everybody for their efforts on it.
Okay. So, this is the format we're going to use. I'm going to ask Mark Kissinger to go through our recommendations, and then I want you to see them in their totality, and we're going to include the recommendations from the subcommittee. Doug, you had asked us also to refer to the recommendations from the other committee on streamlining state and local responsibilities, which we will be sure to do in our report. And then we're going to go through the commentary. We've gotten considerable commentary. We've gotten it from some of you. I got an email from Tom Holt, who couldn't be here today, and I'm going to share his comments with you. And we will then begin to think about any of the recommendations that we want to modify before we take a vote. So that's our goal. And, Mark, take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. So these, you've seen these proposed recommendations before in a lot of different iterations, but these are the ones that we ask you to, we're going to ask you to really consider at this point. These are the draft, final draft principles. I'm not going to read every slide. What I was going to do is read in red, and just if people want, or we can just whip through the slides, whatever people makes most sense. Melanie.
Question is,
sure.
What's in these slides the same as what was circulated in the report?
Yes. Yeah. With there's one amended which we'll get to on health information technology, and I'll point that out. So these were in the draft interim report that's on the website. So do people want me to read the slides, or how do you want to handle this before I start?
I suggest that you go with each one and then ascertain if there's any commentary or thoughts or clarification, and then next one so we can get through all of them and perhaps get to it. If that's all right with the chairs.
That's fine. With one caveat, I think that you need to see all of them together. So if we could just go through all
okay,
through
I'll go through them quickly.
And then go back and then go into more depth, okay?
Okay, sounds good. So draft principle number one, they must provide or contract for all Medicaid long-term care services in the Medicaid package. CCM will be at risk for the services in the benefit package, and rates will be risk-adjusted to reflect the population served. So the really scary, the key point is they're all Medicaid long-term care services in the Medicaid package, and that they'll be at risk for the services in the package and rates will be readjusted. This is additional information on this principle. I'm not going to read all this. This is basically just more explanatory material on this principle. It has a lot in it, but I ask people to read at their table. Two, CCM must include a person-centered care management function that is targeted to the needs of the enrolled population. I don't think anyone probably has a problem with that one, but that's further explained. And I'll note in the middle of that paragraph a change from the report. The CCM must use health information technology as feasible to document, execute, and update the plan of care and share information among appropriate staff and providers. That's a change to the principle. It was built fully on the health homes, HIT principle that is being actively worked on, actively implemented at this point. You notice the words as feasible are important there as a key rejoinder, but the goal is really that, you know, that the CCM must use appropriate HIT to do those things. That is a change. They must be involved in care coordination of other services which they are not at risk. Obviously, the overall goal for the administration is to go to fully integrated, fully capitated programs, but that we're not there right now. So this would be they have to be involved with other services which they are not at risk. Principle number four is the member and his or informal supports must drive the development and execution of the care plan. That's pretty self-evident. Number five. Care coordination is a core CCM function for benefit package services. CCM members will have a choice of providers, so there should be a network of and choice of providers. And that's further explained in the two paragraphs below it. Number six, the CCM will use a standardized assessment tool to drive care plan development. Obviously, we're going to push the UAS New York when available as the tool to be used, but no matter what, they have to use a standardized assessment tool. Number seven, the CCM will provide services in the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of the qualified members with disabilities, consistent with the Olmstead decision. So that's a key principle of the CCM. Number eight, a CCM will be evaluated to determine the extent to which it has achieved anticipated goals and outcomes to drive quality improvement and payment. Number nine, existing member rights and protections will be preserved. Number 10, a CCM with demonstrated expertise will be able to serve specified populations. Obviously, if the model of care is appropriate to the specific population and the CCM has expertise to serve those members. That's the last sentence there. Number 11, mandatory enrollment in CCMs in any county will not begin until and unless there's adequate capacity and choice for consumers, which is kind of the bedrock of the Medicaid program, adequate capacity and choice for consumers. Number 12, members that shall have continuity of care as they transition from other programs. This is a key point of the principle and will be part of the guidelines that are developed. That there's a lot of different programs, a lot of different great services we have in the state. So as transitions happen, continuity of care will be kind of the focus there. Number 13, prospective members will receive sufficient objective information and counseling about their plan options before enrolling. So basically people will know what they're enrolling into and have objective information and counseling so that they can make good decisions. So that's the 13 principles. I'll go back to the beginning, and we can go, if that's okay, Carolyn and I, we'll go back to the beginning and start one by one. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a very brief overview of the 13 principles, and I guess we should just go through number one. There's comments that are going around.
Okay.
That are going around at your table.
Right. We're giving each of you a package of the comments that we received. But let's begin with number one and comments from work group members. Okay, Mark?
Number one, the CC must meet financial solvency standards. Which financial solvency standards? Who are they? Are they SDOHs? Are they SDOIs? Are they net worth? Are they reserve? Are they contingency reserve?
Yeah, that is very much a work in progress. The concept with the principle was that there has to be financial standards or financial solvency standards to ensure protection of members. And if you look at the, some of the federal regulations, it's a federal overlay, there are those protections. Whether it's the SID reserve requirements or another option as far as meeting financial standards is a decision that has not been made. We just want to make sure that the principle, that everyone understands that the principle is that there has to be some sort of financial solvency standard that will be met.
I'm okay with that, but there should be some relationship to, like, consistent with all other
or
entities.
Or long-term care plan, because they're
right.
Different for the MLTCs as opposed to the mainstream plan. So
there should be some reference.
So
point.
What words do you want to use to modify it, Mark?
What words do I want to use? I don't know.
We're coming back to you.
Oh, gee, it's a lot of pressure, Carol.
All right, where you have got to give us the modifications.
So
right.
I think is the idea here that the one of the ideas is that the playing field be level between the managed long-term care plans and the CCMs. So is the principle that they should be the same as the MLTCs, whatever they are? I mean, we know what they are right now. They could change. Or is it contemplated that there be a separate standard for the CCM?
I don't think that decision has been made yet. I think there's a wide range of opinion in the internally and externally on that question. So I think that's an issue for discussion, frankly.
We have not satisfied anyone.
Right.
You know, the Spanish long-term care plans feel that it should be a level playing field. Provider-based entities are concerned that this could be too high a bar. So if there's any virtue in not having satisfied anyone, we have achieved that virtue.
How is this going to be decided? How? What will the process
I think
be?
That's a legitimate question because it sort of goes back to, you know, details that will have to be fleshed out. Mark.
Right. So how will this be decided? I mean, obviously, we'll take the advice of the work group and the MRT, and then the department is statutorily required to issue guidelines in 2 weeks, roughly 2 weeks, November 15th. So those guidelines are the guidelines that will be what CCMs must work underneath. So you know we're gonna take all the advice we can, and then we'll make a decision as far as moving forward. And I'm sure it'll be an iterative process, but there'll be draft guidelines, or there'll be guidelines out November 15th.
Okay, Joanne, you were next.
The first principle to me still leaves open a couple things that I think I have been relatively consistent on since the beginning. One, this still reads to me as a one-model approach, and I think it's inconsistent in my mind still with the legislative intent. But I think more importantly, I think it's inconsistent, as I've often said, about the variations that exist throughout this state about what is doable and what is not doable in terms of models. I also believe strongly that this principle has a good chance of negating the important role that the long-term home health care programs have now played in the state in which they're currently serving 30,000 people and probably over their life have served over 1 million people. So I'm very nervous about their future viability in this model. And therefore, I actually support the language that has been shared by several of the associations to have a preamble that talk about the intent to have multiple models, to make it clear that the intent here is not to have one model, and I would recommend that. I think following up on Mark Lane's comment, I also believe that this model, because it is heavily risk-based, which to me means heavily insurance-based, which means heavily reserve-based, again, will disenfranchise a lot of entities who I think have the capacity and experience and interest in moving to a new level of care delivery, focusing on care coordination, focusing on a different payment mechanism, but not one that necessarily puts them at full risk and one that they would not be able, I don't think, to achieve on their own. So my concerns that I've expressed consistently are my concerns that I continue to express today.
Okay, David.
Well, first I'd like to say if I'd known my email from last night was going to be widely distributed, I would have put it on at least swanky paper and done some punctuation issues. But I'm kind of glad you did because this is what I wanted to say today anyway. I completely agree with Joanne
about David, can I interrupt you? In the full transparency of MRT, we circulated your comments.
I'm
so I apologize for
to know that.
Okay.
I'm anxious to see all the material. All right. I completely agree with Joanne about the need for a preamble that lays the groundwork that this is about, as reflected in the legislative intent in the language, that this is not just about managed care insurance models, that this should be available, this should be an option. CCM, let 1,000 roses bloom, or pick your flower. So I completely agree with Joanne on that. And I think a preamble is a good idea. Specific to number one, I have three main concerns that I want to talk about today. And one of them is about the consumer-directed care that I think if you want to look at my hen-scratched email, I actually have language suggested for number one that actually says rather than merely makes consumer-directed personal assistance services available for eligible individuals, I'm suggesting must offer all individuals the option of consumer-directed services and support the election of that option through the provision of financial management services. I just
that
think
number one.
Yes.
Okay.
I just think it's much stronger. It's clear. It puts the consumer or the member in the driver's seat, and that's where we want. That's who we want in the driver's seat. So that is my recommended language, and there it is right before you in black and white.
I have two things.
Yes,
one,
Marilyn, you were next.
All right. One, I support David's language about the consumer directive, but I would like to add one sentence, and that must be a true model of consumer direction, not a medical model of consumer direction, as it exists in regs today. And the second thing is, I believe in choice. I think, you know, we have valuable programs and all, but I also believe in fairness. And if an MLTC is going to be, we still require to have a reserve and a contingency reserve, the playing field is not level. It could be done away with. Everybody could be made, you know, to have the same thing. Or, you know, many of the long-term care programs can continue to work as providers if they don't want to assume the risk as a contracted provider in a network, an MLGC. So there are other ways of those organizations surviving. It doesn't, you know, so I think that has to be looked at when we look at it for three reasons. One, choice is important. Two, everyone should, you know, if you're going to take on responsibility of providing all of the services that that long-term care plans have to, you have to be able to do that. If an entity wants to continue doing the care management, that's a different issue. That can be done on a contractual basis. So I think you should have choice. I think it's important. I think you have many organizations throughout the state that do a great job, but it has to be a similar standard, or if they can't or do not wish to take a financial risk, they can become a provider in the network or let's get this reserve gone for the MLTCs.
So let me try to capture the issues first as I understand it. Principle number one has, I think, several key components. The first is that the CCM should be responsible for the full spectrum of Medicaid finance long-term care services. And I have spoken in favor of that before, so I was just going to speak in favor of it again because I think it is important in integrating the system to be responsible for the whole spectrum of services. And hopefully you have the incentive wherever possible to make available home and community-based services. The second part of it is that there will be a risk-based payment. The third is that payment will be risk-adjusted based on a number of factors. And I'll come back, David, to your, you know, issue. But those are the three elements. So let me turn to the work group. Joanne, you know, and you in particular, is there some modification we can make? I mean, the fiscal solvency is tied to the fact that you're assuming risk for a population. So is there some change we can make in that language that would address your concerns and ensure that we allow for provider-based models, but provider-based models that cover a bundle of services and assume risk.
But there are,
go ahead.
There are provider-based models. There are provider-based models now. And if one were to go ahead and set up an ACO, you would probably have to set up reserves consistent with whatever that risk arrangement is. So I think that Marilyn said it, it's been said before, if someone can come up with a way that you can go ahead and operate as a provider where you're taking full risk and where you're getting a capitated payment to do it, how would you set up a reserve arrangement that is not insurance-based to deal actuarially with what might happen if you needed to cover care? Because ultimately, the liability rests with whoever it is that's the entity that needs to coordinate and deliver the care completely.
Okay, Joanne, see if you know if you can help us with some modifications here.
Yeah, first I guess I'd like to respond to Eli because this is where I think you and I diverge. Your assumption about being able to be a provider-based organization and assume full risk is a model that only works when you have a large enough population base to draw from. And I think there are a lot of communities in the state north of New York City that will not have that capacity. So that leaves them one option, which Marilyn has talked about, which is subcontracting. I think that's a disservice to them to assume that with all the years of experience that they bring, the only role that they can play is in the subcontracting arrangement. So back to Carol's question, I guess. I think there is some language that has been suggested again, and I'm not here to be a foil for the associations, but I do believe you have a lot of very intelligent people who have sat around the table now for probably days trying to come up with some language that at least gives some flexibility in how we approach the question of financial risk. And it is particularly troublesome to me when in conversations the comment is, well, large organizations will have the ability to have enough reserves in order to meet the test that we're going to have. I extend that statement to mean that smaller organizations will not meet the expectations of the state and therefore will not be able to be authorized as a CCM. So while I understand our desire to focus on principles, you can't do principles in isolation of conversations that are happening elsewhere, which really suggests there is a one model concept that is being suggested coming out of these principles. So I think there is language, they've suggested language. I don't know why we can't at least give it a shot to see whether or not it has some traction.
Okay, Valencia, Mark, do you want to chime in here? Oh, I'm sorry, Kate.
I just want to, in continuation of the full transparency, I do know my senator submitted a letter stating that he felt we were not interpreting their intent behind this legislation, and I know other senators did, and I haven't seen those letters here, but Senator Valesky did send me a copy of his letter, and I don't know if those that received the letter can share a little bit of the concerns of any of those legislators that did send it out to us, because I think it's important we all know that some of our legislators don't believe that we are interpreting their intent behind it, and their intent was to include non-insurance-based models, at least according to Senator Valesky.
Okay. I just, again, in all deference, and I, you know, we were given a charge, and that was the purpose behind what this group was supposed to do. And I have asked associations and I've asked others that if you can tell me how you can create a fully capitated model that does not have insurance principles that underline how you maintain control over risk, show me what it is, or explain to me how it can be done, and I'll be happy to embrace it. But nothing that I've read from any of the associations or any of the individuals who have spoken to me have given me the framework of something that I could use as an alternative. If you take full capitation and you take full risk, you've got to ensure for the client's sake. We're not talking now just for the entity. You have people that you contract with who expect payment. You have people that you're insuring that expect coverage. And you need to be able to have a net that insures that.
Okay. Betty.
You know, I don't operate a long-term home health care agency, but as Joanne said, they have been serving 30,000 people. What is it about this model that DOH is concerned about? It is a managed care operation. They manage certain services. Have we had some of them go under and patients be harmed because of how they're operated? I just don't understand what the drive is to eliminate that model.
Okay. Let me turn to the department, Valencia, Carla, Linda, or Mark. Any one of you can jump in here.
If I'll take a shot at it.
I don't think that it was the model. I think the department or the administration is moving, trying to move away from fee-for-service models. And I think they're trying to build up arrangements where they are contracting for an array of services. And so that they want the entity to be responsible for covering a full array of services. And when you get to that about holding entities at risk, we have to ensure that there is sufficient reserves there. We've had situations in the state where plans may have dipped into their reserve requirements, could not pay their claims, and wind up withdrawing from the market, and have had to pay providers 30 cents on the dollar because they didn't have sufficient reserves. So in going into the door, one of our major activities before we certify, deem an entity acceptable to take on risk is to ensure that they can maintain the appropriate reserve requirements and escrow requirements. And I think it's not necessarily the model that's being questioned, it's how the model operates. And I think that's why if they can take on risk, I think the department is not does not object to any entity that can take on the risk and secure funding to ensure that if there are services that go beyond a certain threshold, that they have appropriate reserves to continue to pay providers. So, I mean.
And I'm also in concurrence relative to, you know, the model of risk and the association of being able to make sure that coverage is provided and continues to be provided to its membership as well as providers getting paid. It's very critical that the providers, whomever is providing that level of service, will in fact be paid as opposed to waiting in line and getting 30 cents on the dollar. And regardless of whether you're provider-based or insurance-based or whatever, the standards should be the same because the risk is the risk.
Okay. Mark, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, no, I think just amplify earlier comments. I think the other piece is the principles that we're talking about all Medicaid long-term care services, which means institutional and non-institutional Medicaid long-term care services. So that is a different concept than the Lombardi program, long-term health care program, which is a great program, but it's a different concept than that. So if you know, what the legislature passed and you know, delegated authority to the administration actually to set up guidelines on these models. So that's why we're here, but it's all long-term care services, not just some of the long-term care services.
Okay, Michael?
I think we're suffering from some imprecision in our language. I don't understand the concept that a provider-based model and an insurance-based model are mutually exclusive, but that seems to be an undercurrent that's underpinning this argument. So perhaps someone can clarify that for me.
Okay, so, I mean, that is a good point because I think that is something that has been posited as like two ends of the spectrum. What do people mean by an insurance-based model? And I would have to say that tends to have a more negative aura. So what do we mean by an insurance-based model? Alan?
It seems to me that there are a number of us around the room that have existing plans that are not insurance companies. There might be a couple insurance companies in the room as well, but I don't consider the Jewish Guild for the Blind or Visiting Nurse, or Beth Abraham, or MJHS, at their core to be insurance companies. So we are at our core very much provider-based. When we talk about insurance principles, what I think we're all meaning is that at the end of the day, there are sufficient reserves or funds available, or however you want to call it, hypothecated balance sheet items, whatever you want to use as a term, to cover any risk that the plan has assumed. When we began the program, we weren't given a dollar amount saying we had to have $10 million in reserves. We were given a number, which was a, Valencia, help me, I think it was the percentage of premium that we would be required to hold in reserve. As we took more members on, as we took more risk on and our acuity went up and our rates went up, so too did the reserves. But we didn't have those requirements on day one.
But So I think what you're just what I think I'm hearing at the highest level is that you are a provider-based organization that successfully and without regret took on the requirements associated with an insurance-based model.
Well, I think you put a couple words in my mouth.
The word the regret.
I can say now with perfect hindsight, Michael, that I have no regret. Had you asked me in year five, when we were $22 million underwater, did we have regrets in that year? Sure we did. Did we think we made mistakes in that year? Yes, we did. But were we able to dig out of the hole with the help of the state and very good support from the state?
Right.
And the answer to that question is yes, too. At the issue is, when we got into this, and let me be very personal about this, because I think I'm a good provider-based as opposed to an insurance-based program.
Because you were both.
Well, we have an insurance element to the program because I have to have the reserves.
Right.
But all of our history, our 100-year history, has been as a provider of healthcare services,
right,
not as an insurer of them. So when we transitioned into this program with a piece of our operation, we did so understanding that we had to have
mm-hmm.
a reserve to meet the whatever the requirements were of the state.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't understand, because there weren't models around that we could copy, I think at that time VNS may have been the only one that had a long history of doing this, and to some extent Metropolitan, we didn't have a large core of people we could go to and say, how do we do this? How do we set it up? And the state didn't have that. We make mistakes.
No, I'm not saying it was seamless or that it wasn't tough, but I think fundamentally, you know, you and the person sitting to your right who runs a provider-based organization that's at risk for 500,000 Medicaid managed care members in New York are evidence that these are not two mutually exclusive criteria.
I think, let me say, first of all, that I think that if you're taking risk, you have to have reserves, and I think that playing field should be level. However, I think what we're doing right here is a little bit different than the 10 years or so that we implemented and grew the Managed Long-Term Care Program. We're talking about a mandatory program that is starting in the spring. So I think that, you know, the challenge is for smaller providers to be able to grow and develop the capital to build these programs in a very short period of time. And I think that is a real challenge that has to be acknowledged. But, you know, you have indicated that in terms of the level of reserve, you know, that hasn't been decided. So I think, you know, one thing that could be contemplated is a reserve level that perhaps, you know, transitions to the same level that others are at. And if that's something that you think is on the table for consideration, I think, you know, maybe that is something that could be helpful.
So I want to support what Kathy just proposed, and the second thing I want to say is that I do support having reserves, and I'll tell you why, because I watched over the years where there have been providers that went out of business, and there were numerous other providers, subcontractors, that were left unpaid, and it actually affected our workforce rather dramatically. And so there are other people to be considered in this dynamic, and so I would propose that there's not only some provision to transition and ramp up, and again, this is going to go back to however the department decides to structure this, but I would also suggest that it has to do with the continuity principle that's in here, because as we carved in the personal care benefit to managed care, the department has been playing with HRA some role in oversight of what happens to both the plans, the rates of payment, and the workers and the patients. So I think that there is a transition component that is also married to one of the other principles that needs to be considered as well as we make this movement. And I would say one other thing, there is also a principle that says we're not going to do this in areas where there's not geographic capacity and choice. So how does that work with this as well?
Thank you. I agree with Carol. I was thinking exactly about the continuity principle that we've all committed to as being fundamental to this transformation or transition. The other thing, I think we're stuck. I think we're hamstringing ourselves a little bit around the language. We're using the word reserves and insurance models, and that's a funding mechanism. as opposed to what does the organization fundamentally do? And I agree with Alan that most of us, maybe all of us, but certainly most of us are provider organizations. I have 16 sites around the city and thousands and nurses going and social workers and so on going into thousands of homes. The language on the slide says financial solvency. That's to ensure continuity of care. It's to ensure that, you know, if these are publicly funded programs, that the business is viable, can serve its members, can pay its bills, can pay the other providers who are also paying, who are also caring for the members. I can't help but wonder whether we're stuck in part because we haven't figured out the other financing mechanisms that would meet that standard. But I think the language allows for that. And I think then the key becomes figuring out what is that financing mechanism, including one that would make it possible for smaller organizations to sort of be viable. But it's a chicken and egg thing, right? Until we solve the financing mechanism, I think we're going to continue to be hung up on what we know exists today.
Okay, Marilyn, well, I really agree with what Carol is saying. And I think something that we lose track of, you know, is one of different way methods of payment. We have fee-for-service, where a provider is paid per hour, for as many hours of whatever sort of services. We have programs like the Lombardi program that has an individual cap on that. And then we have long-term managed long-term care, which uses a congregate cap. And based on that, it's given the plans and the ability, you know, to not look at an individual member in the terms of we get this amount of money and we can't spend more than this because it puts you at risk. You're over 75% or fee-for-service is, you know, paying for unnecessary services, quote-unquote. So I think that when we talk about risk and all, we need to flip it and talk about advantages. If you have a plan that is, and I hate insurance-based plans. I don't see us as a plan. I agree with Alan. We function like providers of health care services and CCMs. Well, what? Yeah.
I didn't take it personally.
And so how do we embrace the idea of an MLTC being able to think out of the box and provide higher services hours to those who need it, and yet still become stay solvent because you have other people in your mix. At the same time, making sure organizations, providers that are doing a great job today continue to be available. So I think it's not always with the downside, but what do we want? What's good about the model? And then what has to be broadened so that it's more choice.
Okay, Betty.
I guess one of the things in, you know, the whole idea of taking on risk, the other side of the coin is what's the critical mass that's needed to be able to sustain an operation, and are there any criteria? 500,000 people, not a problem. You know, so if you have 10 people go into a nursing home, not a big deal. If you have 300 people and 10 of them go into the nursing home, that could tip the cart over. So if there was some way to say, what is the critical mass that is needed for these two operational entities to be able to be successful? And does a community have that many people and have two willing and able providers? And if not, then that wouldn't apply to that county or whatever that region is. But you have to have some kind of, you know, just like you have to have a guideline that says what are the amount of reserves, I say you need to take a very serious look at what is the critical mass from an actuarial standpoint to assure an efficient and effective operation.
Okay. So for this part of it, we're going to be financial solvency, which is a fairly general term. And we could amend this to put in something that acknowledges what Kathy tried to capture which is that this is going to be a short-term fund. We want to hold on to the treasures in their state, those who have provided really good service for many, many years. And if there are a way, as we implement financial solvency, to do it to enable smaller entities to become CCM. I mean, the field is open, but the question is, what can we do in implementation that would be willing to do that?
Just as a comment. In principle number 11, which I know is general, it says mandatory enrollment into CCMs in any county will not begin until and unless there is adequate capacity and choice for consumers. Now, if there isn't capacity, if there isn't a structure, if there isn't options in terms of choice, it can't be done, and it's not going to be implemented. I think that, you know, there's a difference between being far more specific about what it is you want as an outcome, but it seems clear in principle number 11 that if you only have 300 people in the county and there isn't a capacity to have several choices and there isn't an ability to go ahead and implement the mandatory program, it's not going to be done.
I think we have to step back from it and look at the fact that we're not recreating or reinventing the wheel. We're looking at this like an academic exercise, and we're designing something that's never existed. All of us that are doing this now at some point were novices. We were entering into the program for the first time, and we didn't start out with 500 or 1,000 or 5,000 or 500,000 members. So we have within the health department the knowledge, skill, and expertise that's necessary to shepherd programs as they grow, to build reserves on a phase-in basis, as Kathy suggested. When we, again, 12 years ago, the program requirements, I'm not sure what they are today, but 12 years ago, there was P&L risk sharing with the state for, I think initially it was 5 years, and then it got narrowed to 3 years, and then they built into the formula profit percentage. All of those are concepts that work very well and help programs grow. It's, I think, apocryphal that of all the programs that were in existence or started 12 years ago, how many of them have gone out of business and how many of them have gone bankrupt? I'm not aware of any. So whatever the department was doing then and continues to do, I think it's working pretty well. The fear, and I think the fear is palpable, is that that's not something we want to do because we've never done that. And that was certainly our case. And I know when we got into this, people thought I was crazy. My board thought I was crazy. It's worked out well. It's worked out well for us. It's worked out very, very well for the people that we serve. So I don't think we need to be as afraid of it as non-participants are. I think the state needs to step up a little bit more and articulate the phase-in and how they're going to help people ramp up, because I think that really is a very, very important concept. And at the end of the day, I think we need to look at the experience of all those of us who have done this to see what are the parameters of success. You're absolutely right, Betty, that there is a threshold size, and the risk does go down as the numbers go up. Our actuaries argue with us that we're less than a quarter of the way of where we need to get to be able to assume that risk. Actuaries are never satisfied. On the other hand, the fact is the program is still alive and doing well, and the members are getting service. So I think the department can help by creating some structural framework. They can help by creating some ramp up or phase in. And I think that for an existing Lombardi that wants to become a full blown care coordination model, there is a clear path.
Right. Mark, you're going to have the last word, and then we're going to go to David.
Well, I've been working feverishly relative to the language that's requested. And what I would suggest is as follows. Why we're focused on financial solvency is the beginning where it says risk. We'll be at risk. So when you talk about risk, you've got to talk about financial solvency. So as an idea, the CCM must meet financial solvency standards consistent with the requirements and standards applicable to risk-bearing capitated models. so there gives you some level of freedom. I'll read it again. The CCM must meet financial solvency standards consistent with requirements and standards applicable to risk-bearing capitated models. There is a ramp-up when you first start your business in an insurance, or excuse me, in a risk-bearing situation. You have a graduated where you have your projected medical expense, the, quote, contingency reserve, and that ramps up to, I believe, a maximum of 5%. That has to be put away into an escrow account. There's also, quote, net worth requirements that most recently were modified by the state. We're 12.5. Now we're back down to 7.5. It has to be ramped up in 2018 up to 12.5. But if you talk about risk, you've got to have talk about solvency.
Okay. All right. Can I ask you a question? The association letter here, their language says the CCM must be financial solvency standards, or in the case of provider-based models, financial feasibility requirements for providers under the public health law. What are those currently?
It depends on the provider type. I mean, when we look at nursing homes for new establishments, there's a financial feasibility requirement. When we look at other providers, there are different requirements.
So then why?
It's not a risk bearing entity. It's a provider. It's a different scheme.
Taking an old model.
Well, but it sounds like we have other models that don't have the same requirements, but we've decided for CCMs are going to require everybody to have the same.
No, a nursing home, a standalone nursing home to establish is different than someone that provides or contracts for all Medicaid long-term care, or home care provider on its own, a licensed home care provider, and there's financial feasibility requirements. Different, that's a totally different animal than someone who provides or contracts for all Medicaid long-term care services.
All right, David, on to the issue that you raised, which had to do with just not making consumer-directed care available, but you said proactively.
Right. It says, currently it says, it's available for Medicaid-covered long-term care, makes consumer-directed personal assistance services available for eligible individuals. That's what it currently says. I'd like it to say, must offer all individuals the option of consumer-directed services and support the election of that option.
Okay, so I have a question for you. I just happened to look at the statistics yesterday for BNSNY Choice. So 62% of our enrollees are moderately or very cognitively impaired.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who are, you know, an 89-year-old who is very cognitively impaired, do I need to proactively offer consumer-directed care?
Carol, there's an easy way. There's already a standard.
Okay, so explain that to me.
The standard is you have to be deemed to be self-directing, which means you have to be able to hire, fire, do a timesheet, and direct somebody. If you cannot, you're not eligible unless you have a surrogate who consumes all
those. David's kind of proposition, for people who are self-deemed, however that is determined, self-directing, or who we know they're self-directing, then we should proactively offer them.
Or if you have someone who is acting as a surrogate.
That's the idea?
Yeah, and it's based on assessment.
But don't you think that determining whether the individual is self-directing is not necessarily happening before you offer consumer-directed?
No,
right.
No.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
So how is this working? I'm practical here. Okay.
A great example of how the question of implementation of these principles and guidelines is to happen. And you mentioned earlier that we could have a recommendation that this group continues to meet, or there are other groups continuing to meet on particular issues. We are very supportive of maintaining the consumer-directed model as it exists now with the fiscal intermediary. We are very supportive of having plans or CCMs, whatever they end up being, contract with the fiscal intermediary, and we believe that's necessary to the continuation of the consumer-directed plan as it exists now.
And the determination of self-direction or whether or not the individual has a self-directing other. All that's working in the plan right now, and that's one reason, or in the program right now, why we think either to have the language that David has in here about proactively offering the program, or to have another group that is looking specifically about how this program is going to transition into managed long-term care. Because it's a program that is fundamental to establishing an individual's freedom to live in the community. It's the most effective way to ensure that we implement.
And it's cost effective.
Absolutely.
And as a plan, we've done it. We've done it since day one, and it's been worked out with HRA on how the details of that work, and we can share that.
So let me put forth the possibility. I read Brian O'Malley's letter, and I, what about your suggestion, David? And we have a viable and effective consumer-directed program in New York State. It is not a consumer-directed program. And we have managed to put together the elements for thousands and thousands of people that seem to be working. It has an FI component and, and different parts that I think don't always mesh gears with how we're conceptualizing CCM as I think about it. So I'm wondering if we should try to put together a group that will take a closer look at how to, implement the consumer-directed models in the world of CCM.
Well, I'm curious, who is the we that you're talking about? When you say we have a consumer director, do you mean the state?
The state, New York City.
Because there's about this many people in it compared
to
the rest of the
Not in New York City.
Right, but compared to the rest of Medicaid, compared to the rest of the long-term care system?
But it's a model that works that if we look at it.
I understand that completely. I'm just saying I think the principles ought to be very forceful in recognizing this works and making sure it is expanded to those who want it.
I think that, I agree with Carol and everyone else that we need to look at this more, but I think maybe the way to address what David is saying is just say, then that the plans must offer consumer direction, which is true to the model, the successful model that's been used in New York State.
Okay.
Or something, or even more New York City, whatever you want to do.
All right, Carol, you were next, and then Valencia, I'll come to you.
New York State.
I just want to speak in favor of a separate work group because there are a variety of ways it can be integrated, and they're not all acceptable by the consumer-directed community. So without taking further time on this particular issue, I think your suggestion is a very good one, Carol.
Valencia.
I was just going to add that, we have recently integrated personal care in the mainstream program, and one of the tenets that we have is so that consumers who are qualifying for personal care are provided with information on the consumer-directed program. So there are ways to implement this to provide information, to disclose the program, and allow a person to have materials, discuss it with someone, and make a choice. And that's what we've done thus far. The benefit is still out, consumer-directed, but even though it's to address making sure that people are aware that if they're in receipt of personal care, that that is an option that they can have. And so we've required plans to share that information to consumers.
So that should be in the principle then that said that.
Okay.
Carol, I support the work group because I'm not quite sure what consumer-directed is. And I need to understand that. I need to understand where there's cognitive impairment. What about the loved one providing that level of direction, which I personally right now in a personal event are having great difficulty having have happen in a simple manner. So I think we need a common definition of that definition. And I think we also have to put it within the context. Don't get upset, David and Marilyn and everybody else, but fiscal realities.
actually it's cheaper than any of those.
But it needs to be in some type of context a fiscal reality. These redesign groups have not been put together to spend more.
It doesn't. It's just proven if you look at the research.
I know, but in the research also, even in a managed long-term care model, years ago they said there should be no more partial cap because it's costing us more money to keep somebody at home than to institutionalize them. That was what a former director of managed care financing was saying. Not anybody at the table. And it was true, because if you're providing 24/7, I'm not saying right or wrong. I just think that we need to get the common definition of what that means, and I think there needs to be an understanding of fiscal realities.
Okay. I think we go to a work group.
Right, let's have one or two more comments, and then we'll try to pull this. Joanne.
All right,
so why
comment.
Don't we try to finish this one and I'll come to you.
All right, Melanie. I just want to note something that Jason Hubbard, who said of the Consumer Directed Personal Assistance Association, that really resonated with me and with the Consumer Directed community too, I imagine. He said that the implementing OLSTED could be done through expanding the Consumer Directed program more effectively across the state, and it was one method, one tool for implementing the OLSTED decision. And we have a definition of what consumer directed is.
We have regs.
It's in the statute and it's in the regulations. The program is working. The problem is, as David has identified, it's not always appropriately offered to individuals who are receiving personal care. And for that matter, it's not necessarily available in every county, although it should be.
Well, I think we had two different issues. I think, David, your issue was, is this being made truly available to anyone who might be a candidate? You know, is it sort of at the forefront rather than in the background? And then the other issue is, how do we take this model which seems to be effective and make sure that we can integrate it into the CCM? So I'm going to kind of try to capture that and putting it into a work group which will try to figure out how to make this happen. Okay. So, Joanne, did you have something else on principle number one?
I mean, I just, when I first raised my concerns, I think I raised them in two contexts, and we spent a lot of time talking about the financial and risk one. But the other piece of it was hoping for some greater clarity that we did not see this as being a single model of coordinated care management, but really having something that led us to understand that there could be alternative models. So we really did not discuss that. There were a couple people, I think, who had some similar thinking maybe. So I would ask that we not move away from principle one without coming to some conclusion about whether we see this as a one-version model or whether we see some flexibility to suggest other models.
Well, I would just raise a question with you. There is no model that's being presented. It says coordinated care model, which means models. It means that there's not one size that fits all. And if you come up with a model that does the things that the principal says that it does, you can call it whatever you want. You can say whatever you want about it. I don't think that there's, you know, once you start defining the particular types of models, you begin to get exclusive rather than inclusive. It seems to me that the principles and the way in which it's been set up is broad. It has certain standards and certain requirements, but beyond that, you can have whatever you want in terms of creating a model to do that delivery.
Okay, Joe?
In fact, I think Jim Introne was explicit about that at our last meeting in saying that these are principles that not only apply to new programs that might be developed in the near future, but down the road as well.
Right.
So I think it was intended to sort of lay out the principles, as Eli just said,
okay,
for now and into the future.
All right, Joanne, you're rejoined in here.
Well, I guess what I'm hearing is that Eli and Joe are in agreement with me, so I don't know why there would be any aversion to having just a general language that says that we have to need principles that the state permit alternate models for CCM management.
Alternate models to what? To CCMs?
To managed care insurance models.
But because, again, I think we're suffering from a lack of imprecision. I read this and I see, you know, inflexibility in the standards that a model must meet. And in the context of standards, I don't think inflexibility carries a negative connotation. And I see flexibility in broad space to develop different approaches as long as they meet those criteria. So I think it's open to, you can read it both ways. Maybe we need more precise language. And please don't give me an assignment, Carol.
I'm not going
to. You're on the work group, Michael.
But different approaches that adhere to the CPM principles will be allowed. Is that
possible that opens the door?
I don't think you need it. I think it's absolutely.
You may not need it, but it might make people feel better that it has been heard and attended to. And if it isn't needed, what's the law?
I'm all for making people feel better, but to me, in my reading, it doesn't change anything because you still have to meet the standards and the criteria.
All right.
Well, so you're going to feel better now.
Okay. All right. Are there any other comments on principle number one? All right. Moving right along here. Principle number two. Any comments on that? No? You call it one.
You need a gravel. You need a gravel.
Principle number three. Any comments on principle
we've got
number
two
three?
I got it.
We're moving.
Okay.
I do on two, I'm sorry.
Oh, you do on two?
My only question is on number two where it says every enrolled plan member, it really should say CCM because we're indicating it is a
good point.
Good catch, Kate.
Are we on two?
Okay, on to number three. Any comments on number three?
Yes. What do you expect the CCM will do to coordinate primary and acute care services? What's the deliverables? What are the outcomes you're expecting?
In our quality metrics, we do have as one of our reducing unnecessary hospital admissions, reducing unnecessary emergent care.
But it's talking about integrated models of care. So as an interim approach, the CCM will coordinate care with primary and acute care services and other services not in the CCM service package. So what is expected and how will it be measured?
Did we not sort of insert some language that clarified that this, you know, to a reasonable degree, given that these are you're talking about Medicare services?
Will be responsible for to coordinate care with. We started out at a higher threshold,
right,
and it'll come down.
Right. So let me just, for example, Mark, coordinating services could be things such like things making sure a recipient or a member or whatever we're going to call the people in CCMs have appropriate transportation to get to the doctor's appointment and get to the doctor's appointment. It could be that when they go to the hospital that the CCM knows about that and is able to inform, you know, have that in their knowledge so when they are working on the long-term care services, they know a hospitalization occurred.
I'm okay with that, but
a range of things that we could mean, and so I don't think we've landed on one, like what exactly coordination means, because that's frankly a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder.
But in your second example, Mark, you're requiring a CCM to receive information from the Medicare program and or from a provider that has a contractual relationship to the Medicare program, but not the CCM.
To the extent we can, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think you would know. You'd want to know that if you're.
Sure, but
right.
Do you want to require the CCM to do that?
To manage the transitions out of the hospital, to get the home care services turned back on.
I think that's all
the drugs picked up.
Right,
and we do that. Yep. We do it now.
Okay.
that's kind of things we're thinking about.
The post-discharge or discharge planning, I got that coordination and integration with acute and primary. But as it now stands, if the patient is acute and we're not at the point of a discharge thought,
right.
What is, other than receiving information, you're not expecting the CCM to be in the hospital setting.
But, Mark, I have a really good example that just happened with a member who was acquired, who had neuromuscular issues, who developed bronchitis. Went to the hospital, they thought she had asthma. Instead, it was neuromuscular and not. Our nurse and our therapist from our plan was able to go in and make sure she had a corporate assistance machine rather than oxygen, which would have killed her. So we do that. Our nurse and our care managers talk to the staff, are involved in it. We know when the members are in the hospital, and all of us do that.
All right, Kathy, you were next.
I have a related question, and it really goes back to a discussion we had at our very first meeting about how this intersects with the health home model. And at that time, I think, Mark, you had indicated that it wasn't clear whether or not managed long-term care plans would be health homes, whether or not they could change to meet the federal requirements. And I question whether you have any additional information on that now, because, you know, if the intent is to have health homes, care coordinating, you know, coordinating all care for, I don't know how they work together.
Yeah, I can speak with, you know, somewhat specificity. We don't know how they work together either, but they will work together, and we've been directed. So how does a health, if a managed long-term care, partially capitated, the goal will be it will be a health home.
So now, you're saying that somebody in a CCM is going to have a health home also?
No. What I'm saying is these two initiatives, which are happening at the same time, must be coordinated in some way moving forward. We haven't said either way that this will mean X or that will mean Y. There's two initiatives going down the track at this point, and at some point we got to connect those two initiatives. So.
I thought you, Kathy, for everyone's sake, did send an email asking again about the health home and how that will intersect with the CCM. And it was something you've raised, I think, on more than one occasion.
Well, I know the state has been focused on the health home model partly because of the 90% matching that comes along with it. And, you know, it just would seem to me if we want to get that 90% matching for care coordination for most of this population,
mm-hmm.
then you would want these CCMs to also be health homes and not to have a separate health home, which would mean they have to do more than just be involved in.
Well, just one other.
No, but the question there is, like, what does that really, when you say that, but what does that really mean, and can we apply those standards to this thing that we're developing? I mean, I agree with you.
Stands right now, I don't think these would meet the standards.
Okay, right. So what I'm saying is that we're creating a principles on this initiative over here. There's another initiative going down the track here. At some point, we're going to have to connect the two in some way. So I'm not comfortable saying that these will be health homes because I really don't honestly know what that means when it comes right down to it. I know broad parameters, behavioral, you know, coordination, social service coordination, a lot of different words people talk about, but I can't speak right definitively right now to say that an X will be a Y. So.
But if they don't, that means then the state would forego that extra matching on the care coordination expenses for this population if in a CCM.
As Mark indicated, it's still being worked on. But if I think about it as we're looking at the mainstream program, I mean, with the mainstream program, for those individuals who qualify for a health home, whether the plan is a health home provider or not, they have to make health home services available. So it's very possible that somebody could be enrolled in the CCM. That CCM may not be a health home, but that individual may qualify for those services, and the health, and they would be required to possibly contract with an entity to ensure that they get it. So plans can be health homes. Not all of them will be health homes. I think that model could work for other entities.
I got an email from the conference call that we have to speak into the mics. So people could remind people to speak into the mics.
Thank you.
I just think it seems a little bit odd to have something we're calling a care coordination model contract with a care coordination model.
Yeah, I,
That's why there's confusion, frankly. It's like
The only point of intersection we've been involved in thus far is we have, in the quality subcommittee, been working with Patrick Lewin on what he submitted for the health home in terms of quality measures. And we've been trying to align with those quality measures. So that is one point of intersection.
Could I suggest, rather than coordinate services, the CCM will collaborate with acute care providers.
Why not primary care?
As well as primary care.
But, Carol, isn't a standard of care management coordinating medical and social services?
All right. How many people here want to leave it as coordinate care? All right, how many people want to change it to collaborate with?
I would never vote for that.
All right. Okay.
In light of this.
Number four.
I'm very flexible.
Do you argue with yourself a lot now?
All right, number four. Any comments on that?
I think it's in the interpretation rather than the principle. I think that many have felt that it has to be looked at as a client-centered, and therefore the client has equal say in the decisions and the right to take risks.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Number five. On number five, I have a comment here from Tom Holt that he wanted me to share on out-of-network services. He said, I want to make sure it addresses out-of-state services. In our region, the only accessible inpatient geriatric site facility is in Pennsylvania. So I'm assuming that Valencia, that would be covered.
Well, yeah, if a plan doesn't have an adequate network to service members, it has to allow them to go into the service area. And usually they contract with the normal use pattern of the catchment area that they are operating in. So, yeah.
In the mainstream program, Valencia, there are border crossings.
Yeah, I mean, mainstream programs are a little different. There are provisions in law that require plans to allow a person to provide a network if they don't have an adequate array of providers or if they can't treat the needs of the member. I don't see why this wouldn't qualify for that.
Okay.
I mean, in that specific instance, behavioral health isn't in the benefit.
Oh, that's true.
Anyway,
you're right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else?
When we presented our draft to make it more consumer-centric, I thought we'd fix this, but our proposal wasn't taken. So I want to raise this again. And maybe someone can explain to me why I'm wrong. Number 5 and number 11, to me, say completely different things.
Okay.
Number 5 says, CCM should not be prevented from operating when market forces preclude a CCM from offering a choice. But then number 11 says, we're not going to allow CCMs mandatory unless there's choice. So, somebody explain it to me.
So
providers within the CCM that a beneficiary can see, and 11 is about the number of CCMs in a catchment area that would allow the state to pull the mandatory trigger.
Yeah, exactly.
Say that a little slower, Michael.
Mark, do you want to say it more coherently?
I'm not sure if I can do that more.
All right, Michael, go ahead. Try slower.
Okay, as long as it buys me out of a future writing.
Not yet.
So I think that 5 refers to the. To a threshold number of providers in a CCM's network. And 11 refers to the number of CCMs that would allow the state to pull the mandatory trigger.
That's not how I heard it.
Sorry,
I think somebody over here said that it's a difference between
their internal standards versus external community standards. So the external one is associated with when you would go mandatory in a county.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is when you would designate them having an adequate internal network for members.
So the issue is mandatory versus voluntary.
Right. For number 11.
For number 11.
Right. And then to be anointed as an exceptional ECM, you have to have adequate network and
CCM choice.
Right.
All right, so number 5 is I am a CCM, and for whatever reason I can't offer an array of services, I can still function, but I can't function unless there's more than one CCM.
No.
So
more than one CCM. Until you said the very last part, though.
Well, but number 11 is the last part.
So the state won't pull the mandatory trigger until they move on.
It can be on a voluntary basis.
That's the external.
Okay. All right.
Just so I'm clear, when we talk about at least two providers were available, so we're talking two home care agencies, two adult days, two nursing homes, two...
At a minimum.
Okay. All right.
But if there's only one social daycare program in the county,
then there's only one.
Only one.
That's all
or that doesn't want, if you don't have one that's up to SNP, you know, to your standard right now, that you can go out, you go on a fee-for-service contractual basis with them, you know.
The purpose of 5 is to not try to weaken standards of what it means to be a CCM. Standards should be high, but to sort of reflect the fact that you've got a diverse state with different sort of levels of capacity in different areas, and you don't want to sort of be rigid about field breakers.
I would suggest, though, and I guess I'm thinking long term here, people are going to be referring to these things over and over again. Well, when guidance is written and legislation and regulation, and so unless you are going to travel around with everybody to explain this, it's not very well written. But I guess I appreciate it. No, I understand it. Thank you, Michael. But I'm just saying, you know, for posterity reasons, we got to write this so people know.
I was just going to say that. I also think this addresses the situation where you may have, you know, two providers in your network. Maybe you have four nursing homes in your network, but maybe on the given day that somebody needs a nursing home bed, they don't have one available.
Right.
And so you still have to provide the service, and you might have to let the person go out of your network.
Right. All right. So my takeaway is that we should try to sharpen the writing on number 5. Okay. Number 6. Anything on that? Number 7. Melanie.
I think it goes to the broader question I raised before about implementation. And this one, I obviously have particular concerns, and I've raised it repeatedly about how is the plan going to be responsible for the state's obligations under the Olmstead decision. So how that is implemented or operationalized is a really big question for me. And I don't know whether that's part of the continuation of this group and what we would be involved in. I'm not sure, but I'm uncomfortable with the not knowing how we are going to be involved in or correct the issue of how that plays out in the community.
Can I ask, and this is what I'm the kind of example I think you're talking about. You have someone in your network who has been disabled, been chronically ill, something catastrophic happens, their disease escalates, or they're put into an acute facility, then into a sub-acute.
That's not what I mean.
Okay. But
what I mean is, how is the state going to hold plans responsible for implementing the Olmstead decision in all that they do?
Okay.
So, for example, what's in the contract that says the plan does X and is responsible for Y, and the if it's not fulfilled, then Z happens?
Could I suggest that be put part of the work group that you were talking about before? Because I think it's part of the same piece.
Well, it's
not.
It's not.
But I don't think we're going to solve that question now. And I think it's an important question.
No, I think it's easier than that. I think that it's case law. The state has to require it, and therefore it has to require the plans to do it.
Yeah, but how will the plan or provider or whatever model of care or structure you have, how will it be evaluated and determine whether you've done it or not? That's the question.
Yeah. But as a matter of law, is that a transferable obligation? I mean, I don't think it is. I don't think it can.
Well, then
how will the state continue to monitor becomes the question.
Yep, we'll get to some of them.
Number 8. There will be now.
One thing I'm going to raise from Tom Holt, I think I asked Mark and Valencia about this, and I think they should just raise it with Mark. Mark, Tom Holt asked, how will tax character and competency be looked at?
How will what?
How will character and competency be looked at for CCM? So.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, Valencia and I haven't really talked a lot about this, so. But we would approach character and competence like we approach every other entity. You know, there's standards. We look at character and competence for plans. We look at it for providers. You know, we would treat it like we do every other thing that we do character and competence checks on.
Okay. All right. Then on to number 9. Anything there? Number 10.
I think there should be something about the risk and the cost involved and should be reflected in this so that because whatever population you're serving, and let's just say in a younger population of people with disabilities, there's higher costs of medical equipment because of the type of wheelchair someone might need. If it's a population that is needs more treatment in the home, more medical treatment, more skilled nursing, mental health.
So you would like something on the risk adjustment.
Exactly.
Okay.
But isn't that already in one?
It's already in one. I was just looking for it. It tells you that the benefit will receive periodic payment to cover the services in a benefit package to promote the appropriate, efficient, and effective use of services for which it is responsible. Payment to the CCM will be based on the functional impairment level and acuity of its members. Risk factors could include, doesn't say it could, would exclude others, functional status, cognitive status, diagnosis, et cetera. There's a whole list of stuff. So I think it basically addresses it.
Okay.
Okay. Number 11. Okay.
I think this, especially coming from upstate, this is where we really need to talk about how do we phase it in upstate and giving opportunity. And some of the verbiage given by the associations, I think, has some of the key pieces that might be able to help us construct a new.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's language that I think I see in the CCLC document. It says where you finish with choice for consumers and opportunity and time frame for appropriate transition of the existing service systems in these counties.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we'll take that. Okay. Number 12. Oh, yeah,
I mean, I think that's also clearly the capacity is different downstate, but it's also a downstate issue as well in the sense that on April 1, there's more work to be done to figure out how we phase in mandatory enrollment. We can't move 30,000 people on April 1.
That's a complete inaccurate statement. We are not going to be moving 30,000 people.
Understood. That's my point.
There's a lot of work to be done. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on number 12?
So for number 12, I think, you know, it's certainly good that we say, you know, that once the new assessment is conducted, there'll be notice provided to the member. But I think adding in some language, and I'm happy to draft some about notice of a right to appeal if there's been a reduction in the care provided.
I'd like to make it stronger and say that if the level of care is changed, people have to be given it as considered a reduction in services, and therefore they have to be given their fair hearing rights and the notice.
Well, I think
we have that in an earlier principle. We have that in
protection.
We do have that.
Okay.
Okay, but let me cast to this, Doug, the issue of which includes notice to the member and notice of the right to appeal.
That's right.
Okay, Carol?
I just wanted to raise an issue related to continuity, and that had to do with a discussion we had at a previous meeting regarding waivers and the use of existing programs for services. And, Mark, I believe you said you would be willing to look at that question of how the long-term home health care program might be used going forward.
Does everyone know what Carol is referring to? If I'm not capturing this accurately, let me know. Because you was that waiver. We were not 100% certain that the current waiver enables
that's right.
the program to subcontract with CCMs in the future and managed care entities at large. So I think that's what you're
referring That's exactly to. What I'm referring to.
Yeah, I mean, it's our intent to change that.
Okay.
To allow the long-term health care programs to subcontract or subcontract with CCMs or MLCCs.
Great.
Okay. So I have the change from Doug that we're going to make. And now I'm on to number
Can I just ask one question? It's probably more in the rollout of this, but I really think that we have to define the time period that is. Yeah, what is this period
mm-hmm.
when nothing will be changed?
Okay. All right.
To be standard.
And then number 13. I know Doug, you had not Doug, David, you had a question, I think, on number 13.
Yeah. If you go to my email, I guess this is a fundamental question that I suspect, given the makeup of this group, I probably know the answer to, but conflict...
Take that as a compliment.
Well, conflict-free counseling, which would mean a third party does the counseling that has no fiduciary gain or minus from offering what the options are, is kind of a hallmark of what we strive for to put the consumer in the driver's seat. I will be surprised. I think the absence of it will make it a very interesting discussion at the CMS level. I've heard two objections to this, or three actually. One from providers who are doing it well now, and why can't they just continue to do it? Two is a money issue. Where are you going to get the infrastructure to create such a program? And three is this issue of the relationship, that the provider has the relationship and knows the person well, and a third party will only muck that up. And I think the last one is probably true in the short term. But if we're really going to have a paradigm shift here of this entire structure and system where the consumer is really driving things, it makes sense in the long term. How you go about building it and funding it, I would suggest, first of all, and I'm way off here now, but I believe the BIP money, if the state decides to go for it, is the one place to look.
What is that?
The balancing incentive payment program. It is a hallmark of what we are trying to strive for nationally, that there be conflict-free counseling available to people. And not this isn't just a Medicaid issue. This is our position nationally for everybody. Toward that end, I have suggested language that you can see in my email that talks about independent counselors. And also the last, if you look at my email, the new part was supposed to be italicized, but your state computers aren't fancy enough, apparently, to read italicized when it comes through.
That is
So, but it begins that prospective members shall also receive unbiased information and counseling from independent community-based organizations and be given the opportunity for telephone or face-to-face counseling at the request of the prospective member. No prospective member shall be required to enroll in a CCM until he or she has been given the opportunity to obtain such independent counseling. Such counseling shall include unbiased information about the opportunity to direct one's own care.
Can I answer that in kind of two ways? First of all, the way the plans operate, at least now in New York City, that's the role that HRA was doing. It was giving information about plans before regard to referral and you had questions. But then what called the plans and let them tell you what they are. Okay, so that's true. Now, when you're looking right now, you have two different groups of people coming in to managed care, and this will not change with mandatory. Right now, we have people who have been in the system and have been receiving long-term care services and have a pretty savvy idea for what it is they want, what's worked for them, what hasn't worked for them. Then you have the larger number of people who are, something happens, like Carol has said, for our last meeting, you know, mommy's in the hospital, she broke her hip, she got to get services, and who's going to do it? And they really don't have the time and or opportunity to do this because the hospital is going to dump them in the nursing home.
Right.
As soon as they stop getting paid, they only get custodial stuff. So it's not as simple as, you know, let's have an independent entity come in and do this. Because a lot of times you're acting in the moment, and you have to get someone's services. So that in a path, a shock can go in, you know. You could be.
This is an important issue that I've been concerned about as well, because often, as Marilyn points out, the decision-making process is so kind of crunch. And, you know, and it sort of obviates, you know, the need. It works against the need for a real thorough education and enrollment process.
Well, David's suggestion is very similar to a suggestion that I think is included in the subgroup on streamlining, and which says that long-term, those looking for long-term care services should be entitled to the same navigation, consumer assistance, and all those other types of things that are associated with healthcare reform. And that would, in my mind, include, you know, a lot of the telephonic, online, and in-person assistance, but would really require the development of an enormously complex matrix of considerations to do it, I think.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead. I was just going to say, I mean, I know in the city we don't have New York Connects yet, but upstate we've got a structure in place that it would only be funded, and if the will were there to implement what its vision is, and it happened.
Well, I would kind of agree with that, but I would add that, and again, there's federal dollars coming down around aging and disability resource centers, and I know this, the NYSOFA considers aspects of New York Connects as an aging and disability resource center, but we would strongly argue that the disability part is kind of absent at this point. And the network of independent living centers are available along with the AAAs as a knowledgeable federally authorized group of organizations that could provide those services and potentially through the dollars that are available under the ACA.
It definitely can work. I mean,
Well, and New York Connect is recognized as an ADRC, not just by us, but by the federal government.
I just want to say one question.
Hold on, Marilyn. I'll come back to it in a minute.
Thank you.
Let's just get Joanne, and then back to you.
I guess I wonder if there's a middle ground here. I think that some people would not necessarily need to go to an independent entity to feel comfortable that they have gotten sufficient information to make a choice. Others might, so rather than it being a mandate for everyone to have this ability to go through an independent, really give it them the choice of an option when felt that they needed more information to make the right decision for themselves.
But they should be aware of it.
Right.
They should be.
Back to you, Matt.
Yeah, one thing I just want to caution, the use of websites for getting out information which seniors and people with disabilities, most of them don't have access nor can use a computer, so I can't rely on that.
Okay.
I just want to, again, if we can substitute CCM for plan.
Yeah,
I already.
Thank you. So I'm going to try to do something here that references the other work group and that gives people the option of going to some kind of independent community-based organization with no stake in the ground and try to craft something that captures that. Okay. All right. So let me go over the changes that we agreed to, and I now have them. Number one, we asked for something that would capture phase-in and ramp-up and enable smaller entities to have a shot at reaching the threshold requirements. We talked about a separate work group on integrating consumer-directed care into CCM. And we want language that says that a different approach to it will be allowed as long as these approaches adhere to CCM principles and standards.
And I think, since you mentioned the health home, and care CCM, what is health home?
Number five, we have a plea from our editor, Mr. McNally, to stop at the writing. Number 11, we're going to do something on phase-in. Number 12, we're going to add the notice of the right to appeal. And number 13, we're going to refer to our other work group that we participated in and the option of people being made aware of having some independent entity making access. Under the issues hanging out, I have the Olmstead issue, which we need to go back to, and I have the health home issue. Those are two issues that are still not clear. Joanne.
I may have missed it. On 11, do you have the language on a reasonable transition?
I think it was very, very well written in the CCLC document that they submitted to us today.
Thank you.
Number 11.
Okay, so now I'm going to take a vote, and we're voting for all 13. You cannot pick and choose. So it's for all 13, and I'm going to go around, and you have to say yay or nay. Mark Lane.
Could we have started with George? I don't know if I'm prepared to vote in light of what you just went through. I'm not comfortable with those dangling participles. Forget the other issues list, but just what you went through, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, I'd like to see what comes out of that. Because that's what's ultimately, I presume, going to be presented to the MRT.
On Tuesday.
So,
let's be clear, it's November. The meeting is November 1st.
But Carol says we are the most complex group.
You are.
We pledge that we will get you the language, I'd like to get a sense of, in general, with what we have to get here, there has to be some degree of trust that we are going to try to capture what you have shared with us, and we'll try to work with it, and we'll get it back out to you. But given that, I do think we need a vote today. So all things being considered here, we're going to move that.
I conceptually am okay.
Okay.
That's the best I can do right now.
In God we trust, all others must document.
All right. Okay. You're okay. Alan.
Trusting your comments are in line with what we discussed, I also agree.
Okay.
Until I see the documents, I'm not comfortable, so I'll abstain.
Okay, you're abstaining. Michael.
In general, in an up or down vote, I'm comfortable.
Okay.
Barry.
Yes.
Doug.
Yes.
Carol.
Yes.
Marilyn.
Yes, as long as we get the meat on the bones.
All
right, and Catherine,
I feel you've been
in all our meetings. I think that is a yes.
David.
I kind of feel like my choices are either to get on a speeding train or get run over by it. So for now, I'm getting on the speeding train, and I'm going to say conceptually, yes. But I still maintain that if these three issues I've raised today aren't systematically put into the process as it goes forward, that's wrong.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Fair enough. And we don't want to run over. All right. Melanie. Yes. Betty.
I am, in essence, in agreement, but I'd like to withhold until I see the written document tomorrow, and I will sign up.
Joanne?
No.
Okay. Joe?
Based on the clarifications we discussed today, yes.
Okay. Kathy?
Yes.
George?
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I will vote yes, and George will reserve his right to disagree.
Okay, I feel as the chair, we should not vote.
I agree.
All right, so let me just do the counting. We have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 yays, 1 nay, and 2 abstentions. All right, so we're just going to go on to the rest of our recommendations, which have to do with quality and fair hearing.
I think the road and the rubber are going to meet when you provide the stays, the operating standards. That's what's really going to tell what's going to happen. And those are going to be very, very critical.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So on the quality recommendations, Mr. Kissinger.
Sure. So I'm not sure if people have seen these slides before, so I'm going to go a little bit slower.
This comes from the subcommittee on quality,
all right? They're based on the report that's on the website. So do you want me, Carol, to walk through them?
Oh, I can talk to them.
Okay.
And anyone who's on that quality subcommittee, feel free to chime in.
Okay.
We felt the goal should be to achieve improvement over time and to enable consumers and purchasers to be able to compare the performance of the CCM. And that requires that the quality measures be transparent and publicly reported. We agreed on the criteria for determining measures, and those include be measurable, actionable, risk-adjusted, consistent across sectors, parsimonious, and have a real impact on care. We then, and here is where, Kathy, we actually work with Patrick Ruin, and I won't go through all of it, but he's been working with CMS on metrics that would work for health homes. You have on the slide the quality measures that we agreed on, and I would just say these are very different from the core measures for acute care in most instances because we're including quality of life, emotional and behavioral status, as well as improving or stabilizing functional status, care management, and ensuring the continuity of worker and care to the fullest extent possible. And those are very much specific to a long-term service event rather than the traditional acute care-focused quality metrics. And then our quality subcommittee feels they should continue to convene to review progress made by the State Department of Health in developing and implementing a quality measurement system based on their recommendations. We also heard the recommendations from the payment reform work group, and we think there's going to be a need to kind of reconcile and align the recommendations of the different work groups. We're not the technical experts in doing quality metrics, but I think we do want to make sure that at the end of the day,
these are the right quality metrics to evaluate CCMs on. So that's kind of a very short summary. Kathy?
I just have one suggestion in the first bullet under number three. Should that say reduce inappropriate utilization or unnecessary utilization?
I just want to note the document that was sent from Commissioner Burke from OMRDD, which I don't know if folks had a chance to read it, but it was actually really good. And there were many considerations in there that I think we should think about in terms of the system as well, and particularly in terms of a system that's one big happy family down the road. I think that the considerations for the DD community and the long-term care community are often very similar, if not the same, and I thought they did a great job.
Well, I think that is
thank you. This is Commissioner Burke, and I appreciate the feedback on the scale that was developed this summer by a really collaborative group of individuals with developmental disabilities, their family members, our providers, and I also wanted to note that I vote yes on the principles.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for sending that document to us. It was well done. Okay, so I'd like to take a vote on these recommendations. This time I'll just ask for a show of hands, all those who are comfortable with it.
Yes.
Anyone who wants to vote against it? Abstain. Okay. And then our last one, Mr. Feldman, I'm turning it over to you.
Our fair hearing work group embraced some issues which are on the last page, which are fairly self-explanatory. Consider the possibility of targeted increases in resources to handle the move to mandatory enrollment and manage long-term care or other care coordination models. Providers should receive notice of fair hearings requested by their clients. Training for ALJs pertaining to state law rules and regulations should be evaluated. Consumers and plans should have input to the training. The target time frame for fair hearing resolution should be within 60 days of the request for the hearing. And regulation should be amended to require documented receipt of written notice of fair hearings to MLPC, CCM administrators of record or legal counseling. There were some other issues which were not included in this body, but which were put in a parking lot that basically deals with how to expedite the fair hearing process, and some discussion took place concerning what that might be, but that's in a parking lot because that needs to be looked at carefully by the state. There are financial implications in what's being done on that.
Okay, Doug.
Can I just ask, was one of the recommendations of this group that they continue to meet or have ongoing consultation with the state because of those parking lot issues? It seems like that might be a good move, sort of next step or move going forward, given the outstanding issues that were still on the table.
The state's here. They can take that back. And it'll really be determined by them in terms of what they would like to do in the next steps. Once the November 1st presentations are made.
So I'm going to give the speech on workgroup fatigue. So this is a very important issue. We will continue to meet with groups in all different settings. I'm not sure if we do not have the staff to continue this in a formal way. So,
and I appreciate certainly the sort of staff time and resources that have to go into it, but I just worry that without some plan of formal consultation, particularly with consumer groups, that some of those parking lot issues won't have kind of the stakeholder involvement they need.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is take that back, talk to Jason, Commissioner, note your concern. I agree with you. I just think we got to put it in the bucket with every other thing that we're doing. I think this issue also involves another state agency that I cannot speak for. So.
Carol?
Eli, on item number three, we had also asked if after the word training at the end, you probably should add, and access to the training materials.
Correct, that's what we did.
I think we should take that MLPC
Right.
And
yeah, I have to really, really support what Doug said. This was a committee that had severe disagreements over the principle. It wasn't just up in the parking lot that wasn't dealt with. They were conceptual, legal, and any other kind. And they can't just be hanging out there.
The training should be ongoing. I think we also reflected that as opposed to just initially.
I think that's the intent, but we should put it in there,
And there probably should be some inter-rater reliability element. Because there are variations, multiple variations on the same theme, and you got to have the inter-rater reliability.
Okay. Other comments on this? So we have the training should be ongoing and the inter-rater reliability issue, the fact that access to training materials, and then the whole issue of the remaining, you know, issues that were raised and need to be addressed. Okay, and so Mark, I think you're going to have to go back with both.
I'll go back and we'll communicate.
The next steps here. With that being said, I'd like to take a vote on this. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, are there any other issues that anyone wants to raise? Then, yes.
No, I was going to make a comment, but it's not an issue.
An issue? I'm so focused on whether the Cardinals and the Rangers are going to play.
They are.
Okay. Thanks. Go ahead. Give us your comments.
I think we should acknowledge the co-chair's involvement and engagement in this, which was above and beyond ours, and particularly the folks from the Department of Health, because, again, as we've articulated in various venues, the limited time and effort that they have for each and every multiple complex subject matter, they just keep giving more to each thing, and I think we should, as a task force, recognize and acknowledge both the co-chairs as well as the department.
I guess the question I have is, when and where is the work going to happen that's going to figure out the staging of mandatory enrollment?
Right. That's a very good question.
So I can answer partially. The work has been ongoing. It will continue really ramping up now as we move towards working with our partners with CMS. And the goal of that is that sometime in mid-November, we will put out a draft implementation schedule or plan that people can, know exactly what at least the first draft of the plan is. So you'll start seeing products and things are more and more available. You know, once we get through the meeting Tuesday, MRT meeting, and then we get through the November 15th, I think you're going to see the implementation plan right after that. At least people can have a sense of the next steps. And we've just scratch the surface with our partners at CMS. So I can't speak for them, but they have to weigh in on a lot of this stuff as well.
David has it.
Okay, David.
I've had a cat underneath my porch for a while when the weather was bad, and I thought I was doing a good thing until it turns out a skunk ran out when the weather got good. And I'm hoping a skunk's not going to run out of this process, that it's a cat. And I really do have some very serious concerns still about the lack of promoting and emphasizing consumer-directed care, conflict-free counseling, and allowing a platform where models other than managed care insurance models can flourish. And those are the three pieces I still have very serious concerns about in the principles that we've ended up with today, and they are three that I will continue to pursue as this process unfolds.
Productive in a very short and ambitious time. So I would like to thank each and every one of you for your participation.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I'd like to echo the same, not just to this group, but to the sub-work groups as well, that Carol and I co-chaired in trying to get both the quality and the fair hearing rights move forward. Thank you.
Okay.